which perhaps indicates that it wasn't entirely random after all. There's leftover pizza in there, on a china plate, carefully covered with cling wrap. Who would do that in the middle of a hostage drama? Jim shuts the fridge and returns to the living room. Jack is still standing by the fireplace, holding the partially burned ski mask in his hand, his shoulders slumped in resignation.
No, I can't see how he got out of the apartment, Dad. I've tried looking at it from every possible and impossible angle, but I still don't understand how the hell...
Jack suddenly looks so sad that his dad immediately tries to cheer him up by asking questions.
What about the blood? How can the bank robber have lost this much blood and still...
Jim begins, but is interrupted by a voice from the hall. It's the police officer who's been standing guard.
That isn't the bank robber's blood,
he blurts out cheerfully, picking something from his teeth.
What?
Jack asks.
Who's your son?
The officer says, with almost his entire hand stuck in his mouth, as if the blood were nowhere near as important as the souvenir from his lunch that had gotten stuck in there. The hand reemerges with a piece of cashew nut, and the newly liberated mouth laughs and looks remarkably happy.
Sorry,
Jim says, with rapidly dwindling patience. The cheerful police officer points at the dried blood on the floor.
I said, that's stage blood. Look at the way it's drying. Real blood doesn't look like that,
he says, holding the piece of cashew nut as if he's unsure whether to throw it away or frame it as a memory of this great personal achievement.
How do you know that?
Jim asks him.
I'm a bit of a magician in my spare time. Well, to be more accurate, I'm a bit of a policeman in my spare time.
His expectation that Jim and Jack are going to laugh at that turns out to be an optimistic prognosis, so he coughs rather forlornly and adds,
I do a few shows, stuff like that, old people's homes and so on. Sometimes I pretend to cut myself, and then I use stage blood. I'm quite good, actually. If you've got a pack of cards on you, I can...
Jack, who has never looked like he just happened to have a pack of cards on him at any time in his life, points at the blood.
So you're quite sure this isn't real blood?
The police officer nods confidently. Jack and Jim look thoughtfully at each other. Then they each switch their flashlights on, even though the ceiling lights are already on, and start to go through the apartment, inch by inch. Around and around and around. Staring at everything, but still seeing nothing. There's a bowl of limes next to the pizza boxes on the table. All the glasses are neatly placed on coasters. There's a marker on the floor to indicate where the police found the bank robber's pistol. Right beside it is a small table with a small lamp on it.
Dad, the phone we sent in for the perpetrator, where did we find it when we came in?
Jack suddenly asks.
It was there, on that little table, Jim says.
That explains it,
Jack sighs.
Explains what?
We've been thinking about this wrong all along.
Chapter 45. Witness interview, date December 30th, name of witness, Jules and Roe. Because you're witnesses to such a serious offense as this, I really must insist on being able to speak to you separately rather than both at the same time.
Why?
Because that's just the way it is.
Sorry, but has your body been taken over by a demon that sounds like my mother? What do you mean, just the way it is?
You're witnesses in a criminal investigation. There are rules.
Is either of us suspected of committing a crime, then?
No.
Well, then we'll do this together. You know why?
No.
Because that's just the way it is.
Christ, if there's ever been a more difficult group of witnesses, I have no idea where that could have been.
Excuse me?
I didn't say anything.
Yes, you did. I heard you muttering.
It was nothing.
Okay, you win. You can do this together.
Jules is just worried I'll say something stupid if she isn't here.
Quiet now, darling.
See?
For God's sake, don't you two ever stop babbling? I said, okay, I'll interview you both at the same time, but this isn't how it's supposed to work.
Do you have to be so angry?
I'm not angry.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
I need your real names.
These are our real names.
They're nicknames, surely.
Please, can't you just focus on the interview? It doesn't really matter, does it? I need to go to the toilet.
Okay, sure. Because what's your name is a really complicated question.
Stop muttering and just ask your questions.
Right, I'm just a police officer, so obviously it's perfectly reasonable for you to decide what goes on in here.
What?
Nothing. I just need to confirm that the two of you were inside the apartment for the entirety of the hostage situation. Were you?
I don't know about hostage situation. That sounds very harsh.
Please, Ro, pull yourself together now. What do you think we were if we weren't hostages? Accidentally threatened with a pistol?
We were more just an unfortunate consequence of some bad decisions.
Because someone tripped and happened to slip inside a ski mask?
Please, can you both just try to focus on my question?
Which one?
Were you inside the apartment the whole time?
Jules was in the hobby room for quite a long time.
It's not a hobby room!
Closet, then. Stop being picky.
You know perfectly well what it's called.
You were in the closet? How long for? I mean, how long before you came out of the closet?
What did you just say?
I mean, well, no, that's not what I mean.
Right. So what exactly did you mean then?
Nothing. I didn't mean come out of the closet in any way, except in relation to the fact that you were physically inside a closet.
We were in the apartment the whole time.
Why do you sound so angry?
Maybe it's the hormones, Ro? Is that what you're trying to say?
No, it really isn't. Well, I certainly didn't actually say that, in which case it doesn't count.
I appreciate that you've had a difficult day, but I'm just trying to understand where everyone was at various times. For instance, when the pizzas were delivered.
Why is that important?
That's the last time we know for certain that the perpetrator was in the apartment.
I was sitting on the chaise longue when we had the pizza.
What's that?
That bit at the end of the sofa, kind of like a divan.
No, it isn't. How many times do I have to tell you that it's nothing like a divan? Do you know how you can tell that a chaise longue isn't a divan? Because then it would be a divan.
Give me strength. Are we going to have the same argument now as when I didn't know what a commode was? Do you know what a commode is?
Me? It's a type of lizard, isn't it?
See? I told you.
It's not a lizard.
It's that cabinet in the bathroom under the wash basin, apparently.
I had no idea.
No normal person knows that.
Did you both grow up in caves? Seriously, a commode is a kind of cousin to a vanity. You know what one of those is, presumably? Yes, I know what a vanity is.
How can you know that and yet still call a wardrobe a walk-in closet?
Because a wardrobe is a word used by someone who blogs about juicing and hasn't pooped a solid turd for 3 years, whereas a vanity is a proper piece of furniture.
See what I have to put up with? She was obsessed with vanities and commodes for 3 months last year because she was going to be a cabinet maker. Just before, she was going to be a yoga instructor. And just after, she was going to be a hedge fund manager.
Why do you always have to exaggerate? I was never going to be a hedge fund manager.
What were you going to be then?
A day trader.
What's the difference?
I didn't get around to learning that. That was around the time I started to get interested in cheese.
I'd like us to go back to my question.
You look stressed. It's not good to bite your tongue like that.
I'd be less stressed if you just answered the question.
We sat on the sofa and ate pizza. That's the answer to your question.
Thank you. And who was in the apartment at that time?
The two of us. Estelle, Zara, Leonard, Annalena, and Roger. The bank robber.
And the real estate agent?
Of course.
And where was the real estate agent?
Just then?
Yes.
Am I your GPS or something?
I just want you to verify that everyone else was sitting around the table eating pizza.
I suppose so.
You suppose so?
What's your problem? I'm pregnant and there were people with guns. I had a lot of things to think about. I'm not some preschool teacher counting knapsacks on a bus.
Is this a candy?
It's an eraser.
Stop eating everything!
I was only asking.
You know she opens the fridge in every apartment we look at? Do you think that's acceptable behavior?
I really don't care.
They want you to look in the fridge. That's all part of the real estate agent's so-called home styling. Everyone knows that. Once I found tacos, they still rank in the top 3 tacos I've ever eaten.
Hang on. You ate the tacos?
They want you to.
You ate food you found in some stranger's fridge? Are you kidding?
What's wrong with that? It was chicken. Well, I think it was chicken. Everything tastes like chicken when it's been in the fridge a while. Apart from turtle, have I told you about the time I ate turtle?
What? No! Stop talking now. I'm going to throw up. Seriously.
What do you mean, stop talking? You're the one who keeps saying you want us to know everything about each other.
Well, I've changed my mind. Right now, I think we know just the right amount about each other.
Do you think it's weird to eat tacos at a viewing? I'd appreciate it if you didn't involve me in this.
He thinks it's sick.
He didn't say that. You know what is sick? Jules hides candy and chocolate. What sort of adult does that?
I hide expensive chocolate, sure, because I'm married to a wormhole.
She's lying. One time I discovered she'd bought sugar-free chocolate. Sugar-free.
And then she hid that as well, as if I wouldn't even be able to stop myself eating sugar-free chocolate, like some bloody psychopath. And then you ate it.
To teach you a lesson, not because I enjoyed it.
Okay, I'm ready to answer your questions now.
Wow, lucky me.
Do you want to ask your questions or not?
Okay. When the perpetrator let you go and you left the apartment, do you remember who went downstairs with you?
All the hostages, of course.
Can you list them, please, in the order you remember them going down the stairs?
Sure. Me and Ro, Estelle, Leonard, Zara, Annalena, and Roger.
What about the real estate agent?
Okay, and the real estate agent.
The real estate agent must have been with you as well.
Are we nearly finished here?
I'm hungry.
Chapter 46. All professions have their technical aspects that outsiders don't understand. Tools and implements and complicated terminology. Perhaps the police force has more than most. Its language is constantly changing. Older officers lose track of it at the same rate that younger officers invent it. So Jim didn't know what the damn thing was called, the telephone thingy. He just knew that there was something special about it that meant you could make calls even though there was hardly any signal, and that Jack was delighted that the station had been given one. Jack was perhaps capable of being more delighted by telephone thingies than Jim thought was strictly reasonable, but it was this phone they had sent in to the bank robber at the end of the hostage drama, so it turned out to be fairly useful after all. It was actually Jim who came up with the idea, which he was not a little proud of. Just after the hostages had been released, the negotiator had called the bank robber on that phone in an attempt to negotiate a peaceful surrender. That was when they heard the shot. Naturally, Jack has explained the technology in the phone to Jim in great detail, so obviously Jim still calls it that special telephone thingy which gets a bloody signal where there isn't a bloody signal. When they were about to send it in to the bank robber, obviously Jack told Jim to make sure the ringtone was set properly. Which, of course, it wasn't. Jack is looking around the apartment.
Dad, did you make sure the ringtone on that phone was switched on when we sent it in?
Yes, yes. Yes, of course, Jim replies.
So, no then?
I might have forgotten that. Maybe.
Jack rubs his whole face with his palms in frustration. Could it have been on vibrate?
It could have been, yes.
Jack reaches out and touches the little table where the phone had been lying when they stormed the apartment. It's barely standing up on three legs, a definite challenge to gravity. He looks at the place on the floor where they found the pistol. Then he follows something invisible with his gaze and goes over to the green curtain. The bullet is in the wall.
The perpetrator didn't shoot himself, Jack says in a low voice.
Then it dawns on him that the perpetrator wasn't even in the apartment when the shot was fired.
I don't get it, Jim says behind him,
not angrily like some dads would, but proudly, like only a few dads can. Jim likes hearing his son explain the reasoning behind his conclusions, but there's no satisfaction in Jack's voice when he does so now.
The phone was on that wobbly table, Dad. The pistol must have been lying next to it. When we called the phone after all the hostages had been released, it started to vibrate, the table shook, and the pistol fell to the floor and fired. We thought the perpetrator shot himself, but he wasn't even here. He was already gone. The blood, the staged blood or whatever the hell it is, must have been poured out in advance. Jim looks at his son for a long time, then scratches his stubble. Do you know something? On the one hand, this seems like the smartest crime in the world. Jack nods, stroking the large lump on his forehead, and finishes his dad's thought for him. But on the other, it seems to have been carried out by a complete idiot. At least one of them is right. Jack sinks down onto the sofa, and Jim collapses on it as if he's been pushed. Jack picks up his bag, takes out all the notes from the witness interviews, and spreads them out around him without explaining what he's doing. He reads through everything one more time. When he puts the last page down, he bites his way methodically along his tongue, because that's where Jack's stress lives. I'm an idiot, he says.
Why?
Jim wonders. Bloody hell. Bloody. I'm an idiot. How many people were in the apartment, Dad?
You mean how many prospective buyers?
No, I mean in total. How many people were there in total in the apartment? Jim starts waffling in the hope that it will make him sound like he understands anything of all this.
Let's see. 7 prospective buyers. Or, well, there were really only those two, Roe and Jules, and Roger and Aunt Elena, and Estelle, who wasn't really interested in buying the apartment.
That's 5? Jack nods impatiently.
5, yes. That's it, yes. And then there's Zara, we don't really know why she was there. And then there's Leonard, who was there because Aunt Elena had hired him. So that makes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5...
7 people in total, Jack nods.
Plus the perpetrator, Jim adds.
Exactly. But also, plus the real estate agent.
Plus the real estate agent, yes. So that makes 9 then, Jim says, immediately cheered by his own mathematical prowess.
Are you sure, Dad? Jack sighs. He looks at his dad for a long time, waiting for him to realize, but gets no response. Absolutely none at all. Just 2 eyes staring at him the way they did many years ago after they'd watched a film together, and Jack had to explain at the end, "But Dad, the bald guy was dead. That's why only the little kid could see him." And his dad exclaimed,
"What? Was he a ghost? No, he couldn't have been, because we could see him."
She laughed at that, Jim's wife and Jack's mom. God, how she laughed. God, how they miss her. She's still the one who makes them more understanding toward each other, even though she's no longer here. Jim aged badly after she died, became a lesser man, never quite able to breathe back in all the air that had gone out of him. When he sat in the hospital that night, life felt like an icy crevice, and when he lost his grip on the edge and slipped down into the darkness inside him, he whispered angrily to Jack,
"I've tried talking to God, I really have tried, but what sort of God makes a priest this sick? She's never done anything but good for other people, so what sort of God gives an illness like this to her?"
Jack had no answer then, and he has no answer now. He just sat quietly in the waiting room and held his dad until it was impossible to tell whose tears were running down his neck. The following morning, they were angry at the sun for rising and couldn't forgive the world for living on without her. But when it was time, Jack got to his feet, grown up and straight-backed, walked through a series of doors, and stopped outside her room. He was a proud young man, certain in his beliefs. He wasn't religious, and his mom had never said a single stern word to him about that. She was the sort of priest who got shouted at by everyone, by religious people for not being religious enough, and by everyone else because she was religious at all. She had been to sea with sailors, in the desert with soldiers, in prison with inmates, and in hospitals with sinners and atheists. She liked to drink and could tell dirty jokes, no matter who she was with. If anyone even asked what God would think about that, she always replied, "I don't think we agree about everything, but I have a feeling he knows I'm doing the best I can. And I think maybe he knows I work for him because I try to help people." If anyone asked her to sum up her view of the world, she always quoted Martin Luther. "Even if I knew that tomorrow the world would go to pieces, I would still plant my apple tree." Her son loved her, but she never managed to get him to believe in God, because although you might be able to drum religion into people, you can't teach faith. But that night, all alone at the end of a dimly lit corridor in a hospital where she had held so many dying people by the hand, Jack sank to his knees and asked God not to take his mom away from him. When God took her anyway, Jack went into her bed, held her hand too hard in his, as if he were hoping she might wake up and tell him off. Then he whispered disconsolately, "Don't worry, Mom. I'll take care of Dad." He called his sister afterward. She made promise after promise, of course, as usual. She just needed money for the flight, obviously. Jack sent the money, but she didn't come to the funeral. Naturally, Jim has never once called her an addict or junkie, because dads can't do that. He always says his daughter is ill, because that makes it feel better. But Jack always calls his sister what she is, a heroin addict. She's 7 years older than him, and with that age gap, you don't have a big sister when you're little. You have an idol. When she left home, he couldn't go with her, and when she tried to find herself, he couldn't help. And when she went under, he couldn't save her. It's been just Jack and Jim since then. They send her money every time she calls, every time she pretends she's going to come home, only she just needs help with the airfare this one last time, and maybe a bit extra to pay a few little debts. Nothing much. She's going to sort it all out if they could just... They know they shouldn't, of course. You always know. Addicts are addicted to their drugs, and their families are addicted to hope. They cling to it. Every time her dad gets a call from a number he doesn't recognize, he always hopes it's her, whereas her younger brother is terrified because he's always convinced this will be the call when someone tells him she's dead. The same questions echo through both of them. What sort of police officers can't even look after their own daughter and sister? What sort of family can't help one of their own to help herself? What sort of God makes a priest ill, and what sort of daughter doesn't show up for the funeral? When both children were still living at home, when everyone was still tolerably happy, Jack asked his mom one evening how she could bear to sit beside people when they were dying, in their final hours, without being able to save them. His mom kissed the top of his head and said, "How do you eat an elephant, sweetheart?" He replied the way a child who's heard the same joke 1,000 times does, "One bit at a time, Mom." She laughed just as loudly for the 1,000th time, the way parents do. Then she held his hand tightly and said, "We can't change the world. And a lot of the time, we can't even change people. No more than one bit at a time. So we do what we can to help whenever we get the chance, sweetheart. We save those we can. We do our best. Then we try to find a way to convince ourselves that that will just have to be enough. So we can live with our failures without drowning." Jack couldn't help his sister. He couldn't save the man on the bridge. Those who jump, they jump. The rest of us have to get out of bed the following day. Priests walk out of the door to do their job, as do police officers. Now, Jack is looking at the stage blood on the floor, the bullet hole in the wall, the little side table where the phone was lying, and the large coffee table with the discarded pizza boxes. He looks at Jim, and his dad holds his hands up and smiles weakly.
"I give up. You're the genius here, son. What have you come up with?"
Jack nods at the pizza boxes, brushes the hair from the lump on his forehead, counts out the names again. Roger, Annalena, Roe, Jules, Estelle, Zara, Leonard, the bank robber, the real estate agent. Nine people.
Nine people, yes.
But when they dropped that lime on my head, the note only asked for eight pizzas.
Jim thinks about this so hard that his nostrils quiver.
Maybe the bank robber doesn't like pizza?
Maybe.
But that's not what you think?
No.
Why not?
Jack stands up, packs the witness statements away in his bag. He bites his tongue. Is the real estate agent still at the station?
She should be, yes.
Call and make sure no one lets her go anywhere. Jim frowns so hard that you could lose a paperclip in the wrinkles.
But why, son? What's...
Jack interrupts his dad. I don't think there were nine people in this apartment. I think there were eight. There's one person we've just assumed was here the whole time. Bloody hell, Dad, don't you see? The perpetrator didn't hide and didn't escape, either. She just walked right out into the street in front of us. Chapter 47. The bank robber was sitting alone in the hall. She could hear the voices of the people she'd taken hostage, but they might as well have been in a different time zone. There were eternities between her and everyone else now, between her and the person she had been that morning. She wasn't alone in the apartment, but no one in the world shared her prospects, and that's the greatest loneliness in the world, when no one is walking beside you toward your destination. In a short while, when they all walked out of the apartment, the others would be victims the moment their feet reached the sidewalk. She would be the criminal. If the police didn't shoot her on sight, she'd end up stuck in prison for, she didn't even know how long, years? She'd grow old in a cell. She'd never see her daughters learn to swim. The girls, oh, the girls. The monkey and the frog who would grow up and have to learn to be good liars. She hoped their dad would have the sense to teach them to do that properly, so that they could lie and say their mom was dead rather than tell the truth. She slowly removed the mask. It no longer served any purpose. She realized that to think otherwise would be nothing but childish delusion. She was never going to be able to escape the police. Her hair fell around her neck, damp and tangled. She weighed the pistol in her hand, clutching it harder and harder, a little at a time so she barely noticed. Only her whitening knuckles betrayed what was happening, until her forefinger suddenly felt for the trigger. Without any great drama, she asked herself, "If this had been real, would I have shot myself?" She didn't have time to finish the thought. Someone's fingers suddenly wrapped around hers. They didn't tear the pistol from her hand, just lowered it. Zara stood there looking at the bank robber, neither sympathetic nor concerned, but without taking her hand off the pistol. Ever since the start of the hostage drama, Zara had tried not to think about anything in particular. In fact, she always did her best not to think about anything at all. When you're in as much pain as she has been for the past 10 years, that's a vital survival skill. But something slipped through her armor when she saw the bank robber sitting there alone with the pistol. A brief memory of those hours in the office with the picture of the woman on the bridge. The psychologist looking at Zara and saying, "Do you know what, Zara? One of the most human things about anxiety is that we try to cure chaos with chaos. Someone who has got themselves into a catastrophic situation rarely retreats from it. We are far more inclined to carry on even faster. We've created lives where we can watch other people crash into the wall, but still hope that somehow we're going to pass straight through it. The closer we get, the more confidently we believe that some unlikely solution is miraculously going to save us, while everyone watching us is just waiting for the crash." Zara looked around the office then. There were no fancy certificates hanging on the walls. For some reason, it's always the people with the most impressive diplomas who keep them in their desk drawers. So Zara asked, without any sarcasm, "Have you learned any theories about why people behave like that, then?"
"Hundreds," the psychologist smiled.
"Which one do you believe?"
I believe the one that says that if you do it for long enough, it can become impossible to tell the difference between flying and falling. Zara usually fought to keep all thoughts at bay, but that one slipped through. So when she found herself standing in the hall of the apartment, she put her hand around the pistol and said the kindest thing a woman in her position could say to a woman in the bank robber's position. 4 words. Don't do anything silly. The bank robber looked at her, her eyes blank, her chest empty. But she didn't do anything silly. She even gave her a weak smile. It was an unexpected moment for both of them. Zara turned and walked away quickly, almost scared, back to the balcony. She pulled a pair of headphones from her bag, put them on, and closed her eyes. Shortly after that, she ate pizza for the first time in her life. That, too, was unexpected. Capricciosa. She thought it was disgusting. Chapter 48. Jack jumps out of the police car while it's still moving. He storms into the police station and runs to the interview room so fast that he hits his already bruised forehead on the door because he can't get it open quickly enough. Jim comes after him, panting, trying to get his son to calm down, but there's no chance of that. "Hello, how's tricks?" the real estate agent begins, but Jack cuts her off by roaring, "I know who you are now!" "I don't understand," the agent gasps.
"Calm down, Jack, please,"
Jim pants from the doorway.
"It's you!"
Jack yells, showing no sign at all of calming down.
"Me?"
Jack's eyes are glinting with triumph when he leans over the table with his fists clenched in the air and hisses,
"I should have realized right from the start. There was never a real estate agent in the apartment. You're the bank robber."
Chapter 49. Of course, it was idiotic of Jack not to realize everything from the start, who the bank robber was, because it seemed so obvious to him in hindsight. Maybe it was his mom's fault. She held the two of them together, him and his dad. But perhaps that sometimes distracted him. And for some reason, she had managed to get into his thoughts the whole damn time today. Just as much trouble in death as in life, that woman. Maybe somewhere there was another priest who was more difficult than her, but there could hardly be two. She got into arguments with everyone when she was alive, maybe more with her son than anyone, and that didn't stop after her funeral. Because the people we argue with hardest of all are not the ones who are completely different from us, but the ones who are almost no different at all. She used to travel abroad sometimes, after disasters when aid organizations needed volunteers, to the constant accompaniment of criticism from all directions, both inside and outside the church. She either shouldn't help at all or ought to be doing it somewhere else. Nothing is easier for people who never do anything themselves than to criticize someone who actually makes an effort. One time she was on the other side of the world and got caught up in a riot and tried to help a bleeding woman get away, and in the chaos, she herself got stabbed in the arm. She was taken to the hospital, managed to borrow a phone, and called home. Jim was sitting in front of the news, waiting. He listened patiently, as usual, happy and relieved that she was okay. But when Jack realized what had happened, he grabbed the phone and shouted so loudly that the line began to shriek with feedback,
"Why did you have to go there? Why did you have to risk your life? Why don't you ever think about your family?"
His mom realized, of course, that her son was shouting out of fear and concern, so she replied the way she often did. "Boats that stay in the harbor are safe, sweetheart, but that's not what boats were built for." Jack said something he instantly regretted.
"Do you think God's going to protect you against knives just because you're a priest?"
She may have been sitting in a hospital on the other side of the world, but she could still feel his bottomless terror. So her whispers were half washed away by tears when she replied,
"God doesn't protect people from knives, sweetheart. That's why God gave us other people, so we can protect each other."
It was impossible to argue with such a stubborn woman. Jack hated how much he admired her sometimes. Jim, in turn, loved her so much he could hardly breathe. but she didn't travel so much after that and never went so far away again. Then she got sick, and they lost her, and the world lost a bit more of its protection. So when the hostage drama started, when Jack and Jim were standing out in the street the day before New Year's Eve, outside the apartment block, and had just been told by their bosses to wait for the Stockholmer, the two of them were thinking a lot about her and what she would have done if she'd been there. And when that lime came flying out and hit Jack on the forehead and they realized that the note wrapped around it was an order for pizza, they both concluded that a better opportunity to get in contact with the bank robber was unlikely to arise. So Jack called the negotiator. And despite the fact that he was a Stockholmer, he agreed that they were right.
Yes, well, delivering pizzas could be an opening for communication. It certainly could. What about the bomb in the stairwell, though? He wondered.
It's not a bomb, Jack said confidently.
Would you swear on that?
Using whatever swear words you'd care to choose, and I can tell you that my mom taught me quite a lot of those. This perpetrator isn't dangerous, just scared.
How do you know that?
Because if he'd been dangerous, if he'd been aware of what he was doing, then he wouldn't have ordered pizzas for all the hostages by throwing limes at us. Let me go in and talk to him. I can... Jack paused. He'd been about to say, I can save everyone. But he swallowed hard and said instead, I can fix this. I can sort this out.
Have you spoken to all the neighbors?
The negotiator wondered. The rest of the building is empty, Jack assured him. The negotiator was still stuck in traffic on the motorway, far too many miles away. Not even police cars were able to get through. So in the end, he agreed to Jack's plan. But he also demanded that Jack somehow get a phone into the apartment so that the negotiator himself could call the bank robber and negotiate the release of the hostages. And take the glory when everything turns out okay, Jack thought sullenly. I've got a decent phone, Jack said, because he had the one Jim called the special telephone thingy that got a bloody signal where there wasn't a bloody signal.
I'll call after they've had the pizzas. It's easier to negotiate when people have eaten, the negotiator said, as if that were what you learned on negotiation courses these days. What do we do if he doesn't open the door when we get there? Jack wondered. Then you leave the pizzas and phone out on the landing.
How can we be sure he'll take the phone inside the apartment? Jack asked.
Why wouldn't he?
Do you think he's made rational, logical decisions so far? He might get stressed and think the phone is some sort of trap. That was when Jim suddenly had an idea, which surprised him as much as anyone.
We can put it in one of the pizza boxes, he suggested.
Jack looked at his dad in shock for several seconds. Then he nodded and said into the phone, We'll put the phone in one of the pizza boxes.
Yes, that's a good idea, the negotiator agreed.
It was my dad's, Jack said proudly. Jim turned away so his son wouldn't see how embarrassed he was. He looked up local pizzerias on Google, called one of them, and explained the highly unconventional order. 8 pizzas and one of the uniforms the delivery guys usually wore. However, Jim made the mistake of saying he was a police officer, and the owner of the pizzeria, who was perfectly capable of reading the local news on social media, was quick-witted enough to say that he gave a discount for bulk orders on pizzas, but charged twice as much for hiring out uniforms. Jim asked angrily if the owner was a character in an English Christmas story from the mid-19th century, and the owner calmly countered by asking if Jim was familiar with the concept of supply and demand. When the pizzas and outfit finally arrived, Jack grabbed at them. But Jim refused to let go. What are you playing at? I'm the one going in, Jack said firmly. Jim shook his head.
No, I still think that might be a bomb in the stairwell. So I'm the one going in.
Why would you go in there if you think it's a bomb? For God's sake, I'm going. Jack began, but his dad refused to back down.
You're certain it isn't a bomb, aren't you, son?
Yes.
Well then, it doesn't make any difference if I go in.
What are you, 11 years old?
Are you?
Jack tried desperately to think of a counterargument. I can't let you. Jim was already changing clothes, in the middle of the street, even though the temperature was below freezing. They didn't look at each other.
Your mom would never have forgiven me if I let you go in, Jim said, looking down at the ground.
Do you think she would have forgiven me if I let you go in then? You were her husband, Jack said, looking down the street. Jim looked up at the sky.
But she was your mom.
There was no arguing with him sometimes. The old bastard. Chapter 50. The police station. The interview room. All the blood has drained from the real estate agent's face now. She looks terrified.
Bank robber? Me? How could I?
Jack is marching around the room, waving his arms as if he were conducting an invisible orchestra, incredibly pleased with himself.
How did I not see this right at the start? You don't know anything. Everything you've said about the apartment has been complete gibberish. No real estate agent could be this bad at their job.
The real estate agent looks like she's about to start crying.
I'm doing my best, okay? Do you have any idea how hard it is being a real estate agent during a recession?
Jack fixes his eyes on her.
But that's not what you are, is it? Because you're a bank robber.
The agent looks in despair over at Jim in the doorway, trying to get some sort of support. But Jim merely looks back at her unhappily. Meanwhile, Jack bangs both fists down on the table and glares furiously at the realtor.
I should have realized right from the start. When the other witnesses were talking about the hostage drama, they didn't even mention you. Because you were never there. Admit it! We allowed ourselves to be distracted when you asked for those fireworks, and then you walked right out of that apartment in front of our very eyes. Tell me the truth!
Chapter 51. The truth? It's hardly ever as complicated as we think. We just hope it is, because then we feel smarter if we can work it out in advance. This is a story about a bridge, and idiots, and a hostage drama, and an apartment viewing. But it's also a love story. Several, in fact. The last time Zara saw her psychologist before the hostage drama, she arrived early. She was never late, but it was unusual for her not to walk in at precisely the agreed time. Has anything happened? Nadia wondered.
What do you mean?
Zara replied, contrarily. You're not usually early. Is anything wrong?
Isn't it your job to work that out?
Nadia sighed.
I was only asking.
Is that kale?
Nadia looked down into the plastic tub on her desk, nodded.
I'm having lunch.
Other patients might have taken this as a hint. Not Zara. Of course.
So you're vegan,
she said without a question mark. The psychologist coughed, the way you do if your throat takes offense at you being predictable.
I don't have to be, do I? I mean, I am vegan, but surely other people eat kale?
Zara wrinkled her nose.
But that was bought in a carryout, so you could have chosen anything, but you chose kale.
And only vegans do that?
I can only assume that lack of vitamins affects your financial judgment.
Nadia smiled at that.
So you look down on me because I'm a vegan or because I pay for vegan food?
Nadia swallowed the last bit of both the kale and her self-esteem, closed the lid of the tub, and asked,
How have you been feeling since we last met, Zara?
Rather than reply, Zara took a small bottle of hand sanitizer from her bag, carefully massaged her fingers with her back to the desk, looked at the bookcase, and declared,
For a psychologist, you have an awful lot of books that aren't about psychology.
And what are the others about, in your opinion?
Identity. That's why you're a vegan.
It's possible to be vegan for other reasons.
Such as?
It's good for the environment.
Maybe. But I think people like you are vegan because it makes you feel good. It's probably why you've got poor posture, too little calcium.
Nadia discreetly adjusted her position on her chair and did her best not to look like she was trying to sit up straighter.
You pay for your time here, Zara. For someone who criticizes other people's financial choices, you seem remarkably happy to throw away quite a lot of money on talking about me. Do you want to talk about why?
Zara seemed to consider this seriously,
without taking her eyes off the bookcase.
Maybe next time.
That's good to hear.
What is?
That there's going to be a next time. Zara turned around at that and peered at Nadia to see if that was a joke or not. She didn't quite succeed, so turned away again, rubbed more sanitizer into her hands, and looked out of the window behind Nadia, counting the windows in the building opposite.
Then she said, "You haven't suggested I start taking antidepressants. Most psychologists would have."
"Have you met many other psychologists?"
"No."
"So that's your own analysis?" Zara looked at the picture on the wall.
"I can understand you not wanting to give me sleeping pills because you're worried I'd kill myself. But surely if that's the case, you should be giving me antidepressants instead."
Nadia folded two unused paper napkins and tucked them away in her desk drawer, then nodded. "You're right. I haven't suggested medication, because antidepressants are designed to smooth out the highs and lows of your mood, and if used properly, they can stop you feeling so sad, but often they stop you feeling as happy." She held one hand up, her palm horizontal. "You just end up on a level. And you would expect that patients who take antidepressants mostly miss the highs, wouldn't you? But that isn't actually the case. The majority of people who want to stop medication say they want to be able to cry again. They watch a sad film with someone they love, and they want to be able to feel the same thing."
"I don't like films," Zara pointed out.
Nadia laughed out loud. "No, of course you don't. But I don't think you need fewer feelings, Zara. I think you need to feel more. I don't think you're depressed. I think you're lonely."
"That sounds like an unprofessional analysis."
"Maybe."
"What if I leave here and kill myself?"
"I don't think you'd do that."
"No."
"You said a little while ago that there's going to be a next time." Zara focused her gaze on Nadia's chin.
"And you trust me?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Because I can see that you don't want to let people get close to you. It makes you feel weak. But I don't think you're afraid of being hurt. I think you're afraid of hurting other people. You're a more empathetic and moral person than you like to admit." Zara was deeply, deeply offended by this, and had difficulty working out if that was because Nadia had called her weak or because she had said she was moral.
"Maybe I just don't think it's worth the effort to talk to people I'm only going to get fed up with."
"How do you know that if you never try?"
"I'm here, aren't I? And it didn't take me long to get fed up with you."
"Try to take the question seriously," Nadia said, which of course was hopeless. Zara bounced away from the subject as usual.
"So why are you vegan?"
Nadia groaned wearily. "Do we really have to talk about that again? Okay, I'm vegan because I care about the climate crisis. If everyone was vegan, we could..." Zara interrupted scornfully.
"Stop the ice caps melting."
Nadia deployed the patience vegans have plenty of time to practice when they spend Christmas with older relatives. "Not quite, no. But it's part of a larger solution. And the fact that the ice caps are melting is..."
"But do we really need penguins?" Zara asked bluntly.
"I would say that the ice caps are a symptom, not the problem. Like the trouble you have sleeping." Zara counted the windows.
"There are frogs threatened with extinction that scientists say would leave us smothered with insects if they disappeared. But penguins? Who'd be affected if penguins disappeared? Except maybe businesses that make padded jackets?"
Nadia lost the thread at that, which may have been Zara's intention. "You don't make... what? Do you think they make padded jackets out of penguins? They're made of geese."
"So geese aren't as important as penguins? That doesn't sound very vegan."
"That's not what I said."
"That's what it sounded like."
"You're making a habit of this, you know."
"What?"
"Changing the subject as soon as you get close to talking about real feelings." Zara seemed to consider this. Then she said,
"What about bears, then?"
"Sorry?"
"If you get attacked by a bear, could you kill it then?"
"Why would I be attacked by a bear?
Maybe someone kidnaps you and drugs you and you wake up in a cage with a bear and it's a fight to the death.
You're starting to get quite disconcerting now, and I'd like to point out that I've had an awful lot of training in psychology, so I have a fairly high threshold for what counts as disconcerting.
Stop being so sensitive. Answer the question. Could you kill a bear then, even if you didn't want to eat it? I'm not saying you've got a fork, but if you had a knife?
Nadia groaned. You're doing it again.
What?
Nadia looked at the time. Zara noticed. She counted all the windows twice. Nadia noticed. They looked past each other for a while until Nadia said,
Let me ask you this then. Do you think you mock the green movement this way because it's the opposite of the finance industry you work in?
Zara bit back faster than she herself was expecting, because sometimes you don't know how strongly you feel about something until you're tested.
The green movement doesn't need any help to look ridiculous, and I'm not defending the finance industry. I'm defending the economic system.
What's the difference?
One is the symptom, the other is the problem.
Nadia nodded as if she understood what that meant. Surely we created the economic system? It's a construct? Zara's reply was surprisingly free from condescension and almost sounded sympathetic.
That's the problem. We made it too strong. We forgot how greedy we are. Do you own an apartment?
Yes.
Have you got a mortgage on it?
Hasn't everyone?
No. And a mortgage used to be something you were expected to repay. But now that every other middle-income family has a mortgage for an amount they couldn't possibly save up in their lifetimes, then the bank isn't lending money anymore. It's offering financing. And then homes are no longer homes. They're investments.
I'm not sure I completely understand what that means.
It means that the poor get poorer, the rich get richer, and the real class divide is between those who can borrow money and those who can't. Because no matter how much money anyone earns, they still lie awake at the end of the month worrying about money. Everyone looks at what their neighbors have and wonders how can they afford that, because everyone is living beyond their means. So not even really rich people ever feel really rich, because in the end, the only thing you can buy is a more expensive version of something you've already got. With borrowed money.
Nadia looked like a cat who'd just seen someone skating for the first time. I heard a man who worked in a casino say that no one gets ruined by losing. They get ruined by trying to win back the money they lost. Is that what you mean? Is that why the stock market and housing market crash?
Zara shrugged.
Sure, if that makes it feel better.
Then the psychologist suddenly, and without quite knowing why, asked a question that knocked the air out of her patient's lungs. So do you feel more guilty about the customers you haven't lent money to, or the ones you've lent too much to? Zara looked untroubled, but she was holding on to the arms of the chair so tightly that when she eventually let go, her palms were bloodless. She hid it by rubbing them and evaded eye contact by counting windows. Then she let out a quick snort.
You know something, if people who worry about animal welfare were really bothered about animal welfare, they wouldn't tell me to eat happy pigs.
Nadia rolled her eyes. I don't see what that's got to do with my question. Zara shrugged.
All this talk about organic farming, adverts for free-range chickens and happy pigs. Isn't it more unethical of me to eat a happy pig? Surely it's better if I eat a pig that's lived a terrible life than one of those carpe diem pigs with a family and friends. The farmers say happy pigs taste better, so I can only assume that they wait until the pig has just fallen in love, maybe just after it's had kids, when it's at its absolute happiest, and then it gets shot in the head and vacuum-packed. How ethical is that?
The psychologist sighed. I'll take that to mean that you don't want to talk about your customers and how much they've borrowed. Zara dug her fingernails hard into her palms.
Have you ever thought about how vegans always talk about saving the planet, as if the planet needed you? The planet will survive for billions of years even without human help. The only people we are killing are ourselves.
It wasn't much of an answer, as usual. Nadia looked at the time, then regretted doing so at once because Zara noticed and got to her feet, as usual. Zara never liked to be asked to leave, and that tends to make you more alert to the way people check the time, and the second time they look, you get to your feet. Nadia felt embarrassed and stammered, "We've got some time left, if you'd like. I haven't another appointment after this."
"Well, I've got things to do," Zara replied.
Nadia composed herself and asked straight out, "Can you tell me one personal thing about yourself?"
"Sorry?"
Nadia stood up and moved her head in an attempt to catch Zara's eye. "In all the time we've spent talking to each other, I get the sense that you've never told me anything truly personal about yourself. Anything at all. What's your favorite color? Do you like art? Have you ever been in love?" Zara's eyebrows rose as far as they could go.
"Do you think I'd sleep better if I were in love?"
Nadia burst out laughing. "No, I was just wondering. I know very little about you." Of all the moments they shared, this was one of the most remarkable. Zara stood behind her chair for several minutes. Then she took a deep breath and actually told Nadia something about herself that she had never told anyone.
"I like music. I play music very loud as soon as I get home. It helps me gather my thoughts."
"Only when you get home?"
"I can't play it that loud in the office. It only works if I listen to it at very, very high volume."
Zara tapped her forehead as she said that, as if to illustrate what it was that didn't work. "What sort of music?" Nadia asked gently.
"Death metal."
"Wow.
Is that a professional opinion?"
Nadia giggled, which was embarrassing and highly unprofessional. You certainly aren't taught how to giggle in psychology courses. It was just so incredibly unexpected. "Why death metal?"
"It's so loud that it makes your head silent."
Zara's knuckles turned white around the handle of her handbag. Nadia noticed, so she pulled a pad of paper from one of her desk drawers, wrote something, and handed Zara a note.
"Is that a prescription for sleeping pills?"
Zara asked. Nadia shook her head. "It's the name of a good pair of headphones. There is an electronics store down the street. Buy them, then you can listen to music no matter where you are, as soon as things start to feel difficult. Maybe that would help you to get out more. Meet people, maybe even fall in love." Of course, the psychologist regretted saying that last bit at once. Zara didn't respond. She tucked the note in her handbag, stared at the letter at the bottom of it, closed it quickly. As she was leaving, Nadia called out anxiously, worried that she had gone too far. "You don't have to fall in love, Zara. That wasn't what I meant. I just meant it might be time to try something new. I just think you should give yourself the chance of getting fed up with someone." Zara stood in the elevator. As the doors closed, she thought about loans, the ones we grant and the ones we refuse. Then she pressed the emergency stop button. Chapter 52. While the hostage drama was going on, out in the street, Jack was trying to think of some other way to contact the bank robber rather than let Jim go up with the pizzas. He thought and thought and thought. Because young men may be absolutely certain about almost everything nearly all of the time, but even for Jack, it would have been easier to be 100% certain that the bomb wasn't a bomb if he didn't need to send his dad into the stairwell to test the theory. "Hang on, Dad. He began, then raised his phone and said to the negotiator, "Before we go in with the pizzas, I want to try to get a better idea of what's going on. I can get into the building that's on the other side of the street. I might be able to see into the stairwell windows from there." The negotiator sounded skeptical.
"What difference would that make?"
"None, maybe," Jack admitted. "But I might be able to tell if it's a bomb or not through the window. And before I send my colleague in, I want to know that I've exhausted all options." The negotiator put his hand over his phone and talked to someone else, one of the bastard bosses, perhaps,
Then he came back and said, "Yes. Okay, yes."
He didn't tell Jack that he was impressed that he had called his dad his colleague in such a critical situation, but he was. So Jack went into the building on the other side of the street. The negotiator stayed on the line, and 1.5 floors later, he wondered,
What are you doing?
I'm going up the stairs, Jack replied.
Isn't there an elevator?
I don't like elevators. The negotiator sounded like he was hitting his head with his phone.
So you're prepared to go into a building containing a bomb and an armed bank robber, but you're scared of elevators?
Jack hissed back.
I'm not scared of elevators. I'm scared of snakes and cancer. I just don't like elevators.
The negotiator sounded like he was grinning.
Can't you call in reinforcements?
All the staff we have at our disposal are here, the whole lot. They're maintaining the cordon and evacuating the surrounding buildings. I've called in backup, but they're both waiting for their wives.
What does that mean?
That they've been drinking. Their wives will have to drive them here.
Drinking at this time of day? The day before New Year's Eve?
The negotiator wondered. I don't know how you do it in Stockholm, but here we take New Year's seriously, Jack replied. The negotiator laughed.
Stockholmers don't take anything seriously, you know that. At least, nothing important.
Jack grinned. He hesitated briefly as he went up a few more steps before asking the question he had been wanting to ask for a while. Have you been involved in a hostage drama before? The negotiator hesitated before replying.
Yes. Yes, I have.
How did it end?
He let the hostages go and came out after we'd spent 4 hours talking.
Jack nodded tersely and stopped at the next-to-last floor. He peered out of the landing window through a small pair of binoculars. He could see the wires on the floor of the landing opposite. They were hanging out of a box that someone had written something on with a marker. He wasn't absolutely certain, but from where he was standing, it looked very much like the letters C-H-R-I-S-T-M-A-S.
It isn't a bomb, he said into his phone. What do you think it is, then?
Looks like outdoor Christmas lights.
Well, then.
Jack carried on up to the top floor. If the bank robber hadn't closed the blinds, he might be able to see into the apartment.
How did you get him out? He asked. Who?
The hostage taker, last time.
Oh, all the usual, I suppose. A combination of what you get taught. Don't use negatives, avoid can't and won't. Try to find something you've got in common. Find out what his motivation is.
Was that really how you got him out?
No, of course not. I was joking.
Seriously?
Yes, seriously. We talked for 4 hours, and then he suddenly fell silent. And of course, that's the first thing we get taught.
To keep him occupied? Not to let the line go quiet?
Exactly. I didn't know what to do, so I took a chance and asked if he wanted to hear a funny story. He said nothing for a minute or so, then he said, "Well, are you going to tell me or not?" So I told him the one about the two Irish guys in a boat, if you know that one.
No, Jack said.
Okay, two Irish brothers are out at sea fishing. A storm blows up and they lose both oars. They're convinced they're going to drown. Then suddenly one of the brothers spots something in the water and manages to grab hold of a bottle. They pull the cork out and poof, a genie appears. He grants them one wish, anything they want. So the two brothers look around at the stormy sea. They're stuck out there with no oars, several miles from shore, and the first brother is thinking about what to ask for when the second brother cheerfully blurts out, "I wish the whole sea was Guinness." The genie stares at him like he's an idiot, then says, "Okay, sure, let's go for that." And poof, the sea turns into Guinness. The genie vanishes. The first brother stares at the second brother and snaps, "You bloody idiot! We had one single wish, and you wished the sea was Guinness? Do you have any idea what you've done?" The second brother shakes his head in shame. The first brother throws his arms out and says...
The negotiator left a dramatic pause, but didn't have time to deliver the punchline before Jack cut in from the other end of the line.
"Now we have to piss in the boat!"
The negotiator let out an affronted snort so loud that the phone shook.
So you had heard it after all.
My mom liked funny stories.
Is that really what got the hostage taker to give up?
The line was quiet a little too long.
Maybe he was worried I was going to tell him another one.
The negotiator sounded like he wanted to laugh as he was saying this, but didn't quite succeed. Jack couldn't help noticing. He had reached the top floor now and looked out of the window at the balcony on the other side of the street. He stopped in surprise.
What the? That's weird.
What?
I can see the balcony of the apartment where the hostages are being held. There's a woman standing on it.
A woman?
Yes, wearing headphones.
Headphones?
Yes.
What sort of headphones?
How many different types are there? What difference does that make?
The negotiator sighed. Okay, stupid question. How old is she then?
50s, older maybe?
Older than 50 or older than in her 50s?
For God's... I don't know. A woman, a perfectly ordinary woman.
Okay, calm down. Does she look scared?
She looks... bored. She definitely doesn't look like she's in any danger anyway.
That sounds like an odd hostage situation.
Exactly. And that definitely isn't a bomb in the stairwell. And he tried to rob a cashless bank. I said from the start, we're not dealing with a professional here.
The negotiator considered this for a few moments. Yes, you might well be right.